Hi, you're listening to Manufactured, a podcast about sustainability and the making of fashion. I'm your host, Kim van der Weert, a student of human rights, turned garment factory manager, turned sustainable fashion critic. On this show, I talk to some of the most integral people who manufacture what we wear. They aren't the people you see in fashion magazines. They're the people behind closed doors working in fashion supply chains. On the one hand, people often talk about legislation and regulation as if it's the golden ticket out of fashion sustainability problems. The logic goes something like this. The reason, quote-unquote, bad stuff happens in fashion supply chains is because of weak governance, quote-unquote, over there. Therefore, we must hold brands and retailers in the global north legally accountable for their impacts, including throughout their supply chains, primarily in the global south. In other words, those global brands and retailers are filling governance gaps, again, quote-unquote, over there. On the other hand, there's the curious case of apparel production in Leicester. Despite being in the heart of the UK, a quote-unquote developed country and leading superpower that's decidedly not, again, quote-unquote, over there, labor rights abuses in Leicester's garment sector have long been described as an open secret. This mini-series is dedicated to exploring this paradox. How is it possible that, despite strong governance and regulation, labor rights abuses have persisted in Leicester? What are the lessons and implications for our efforts to leverage legislation as a tool to fix fashion's sustainability woes globally? Each episode is a conversation with a different stakeholder group. We talk to a lawyer working on human rights abuses in Leicester, the leader of a local manufacturing association, a policy expert and government official, and a former production worker who, in recent years, has begun working in community engagement. This series has been co-created with Dr. Divya Jyoti, who some of you may remember meeting on the show before. Divya, a sustainability professional in a past life, is now a lecturer in the Department of Organization, Work and Technology at Lancaster University in the UK. She researches issues of ethics and sustainability in fashion supply chains while continuing her work with reform-oriented organizations. This mini-series has been supported by Lancaster University Management School and the Pentland Center for Sustainability in Business at Lancaster University, working in partnership with Justice in Fashion CIC, a UK-based not-for-profit that works to address imbalances of power and resources across the fashion industry supply chain. Last thing, we want this series to generate discussion and to be a two-way conversation. Share your musings, ramblings, or questions, whether fully formed or half-baked, by leaving me a voice memo or posting to our Curious Case of Leicester community wall, where you can also swap notes with fellow listeners. Links to both the voice memo and the community wall can be found in the episode description. Also, join us for a live virtual conversation on the 3rd of October to debrief and compare notes about these episodes. Spots are limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. Links to the voice memo, community wall, and event registration page can be found in the episode description. In the last episode of this mini-series, my co-host, Dr. Divya Jyoti, and I sit down again with Jennifer Wasak, co-founder and managing director of Justice in Fashion, to wrap up our deep dive into the Leicester conundrum. We peel back the layers of issues, questioning why, despite seemingly robust laws and regulations, human rights abuses in Leicester continue to happen. A word that came up in episode after episode was inequity, which begs the question, what causes inequity between value chain groups? Is it the business model? Or is it contextual and different in every context? For example, in one episode, we heard about the uneven relationship of local government to the Westminster government. Or is it the rules themselves? What role do the rules, whether those are legally mandated, private standards, tools, or even informal norms, have in shaping how power is distributed? We ponder whether our focus on what the rules allow or don't allow is misplaced, and if instead we should be focusing on the how. How are the rules created? Do stakeholders have an equal voice? In other words, the process. So, Divya and Jennifer, I'm so happy to have you here. I've had you both in my ears the last few weeks as I've been listening to the episodes and as part of the editing process. And I just want to start with thank you, because this series wouldn't have been possible without the two of you for different reasons. And for me, the conversations were just, they were really insightful. And I learned a lot from them. And they also kind of re-energized me. And I want to start this conversation off picking up where we started, which is like, we really started this series on a quest to understand a conundrum. So how is it possible that human rights abuses in Leicester, in the middle of the UK, have persisted there? And we kind of set out to understand why this is happening and the implications for legislation in the global north that is aimed at, you know, holding brands and retailers legally accountable for what happens in their supply chains globally. And so I wanted to start by like checking in with you guys, where have we landed? If I had to ask you, you know, how it's possible that these things are still happening in Leicester despite being in the UK, what would you say, Jennifer?
It's still happening. Laws and regulations haven't addressed, and maybe can never effectively address, fundamental inequalities in the supply chain and the business model, particularly of fast fashion. That's my takeaway. We have minimum wage laws, we have enforcement bodies, we have codes of conduct and social audits and all of these programs and laws that are in place that are really protecting the brands and the retailers from trouble down their supply chain. But what these laws can't do, it doesn't matter if you're in a global superpower like the UK. It doesn't matter if you're in the US. It doesn't matter if you're in Bangladesh. As long as we don't address that fundamental inequality of power and resource, there's going to be ways around every regulation. There's ways around passing these social audits. There's ways around paying minimum wage. And as long as that fundamental imbalance is unaddressed, all the legislation in the world isn't going to fix this. It's not going to stop the labor rights abuses. That's my two cents.
How about you, Divya?
So I kind of pick up from, you know, what Jen is saying, but my thoughts on listening to the various conversations was, it is the assumptions which are inherent when we think about rulemaking and rule enforcement, which I think we need to become more conscious of and aware of.
What do you mean, assumptions inherent?
So one is that we can create a rule and that rule or law should help us address and, you know, improve situations and scenarios. There are so many dynamics which come into play. And I think we heard that, you know, in a couple of issues that Shasta highlighted, the kinds of nuances and the role the individual agency choices and decisions, you know, which start playing when they come into the mix. So even if you have something like a minimum wage law, how is that law interacting and intersecting with other, you know, sets of laws and provisions which are available? So I think that is, you know, one aspect. The legal enforcement, you know, is the other, which is about translation of a particular act, how it, that rule will be interpreted and how it will then translate into action. The point around inequity is interesting. You know, we've kind of spoken about this expectation that we should be able to address this imbalance through laws. But rules in itself are devices of, you know, allocating power, and they reflect who will, you know, decide, who should be trusted, who will become, you know, empowered, whose words are, you know, final, who is going to be giving orders, who is going to be taking them. In some ways, you know, within the set of society, those questions become important. And I think that's what I mean by assumptions, that what kind of legislation might even be a solution. So I was kind of left thinking about that. How much of the nuance that is at play of the way everyday decision making is being enacted at an individual level within organizations, and indeed the complexity which was highlighted about the dynamics and the need for a place-based approach. You know, when I was making my notes, I actually started with what you said, you know, the myths which have been busted in some of these conversations. And one thing which I think emerged strongly in, you know, the conversation with Adam as well as Shaista was almost the disservice of the narratives the aspects which have been highlighted in the news and by various other actors that seems to have done a strange kind of a disservice. And that's again what I mean by assumptions, that, you know, we assume that, okay, you know, let's go out and, you know, blow the whistle and tell the story. But is there then a responsibility? And what kind of questions does that begin to raise for us? And connected to this, you know, another set of stakeholders, this whole idea around projects and, you know, kind of parachuting in and saying we will make changes, but then that is not being sustained. And again, ends up, you know, doing perhaps more damage.
So I see different like layers to this conversation. And the first layer, or maybe it's myths, I don't know. But the first like layer to that conversation is like, what drives behavior? What drives people to do bad stuff? And I use bad stuff as a generic catch-all term for all the things that happen in our industry. Not to trivialize it, but just use a term that's all encompassing. But like, why do people do bad stuff? And that's sort of like the first layer of this conversation that I think not only this mini series, but this show in general has been all about. And Divya, this comes to your point on disservice of narratives. I think that in our sector, there is a narrative that the reason bad stuff happens in fashion supply chains is because you have some evil villain somewhere. And sometimes that villain is the brand. Sometimes that villain is the manufacturer. More often it's the manufacturer. And also those villains are not created equal because they don't, and those narratives are not created equal because there's not the same amount of power. But like in sort of everyday conversations, there's usually a villain in this story. And that was my personal experience as a factory manager. I remember like sitting in a cafe in Phnom Penh with my husband when I was sort of coming towards the end of my time there. And I remember just like trying to articulate to him that I thought working as a factory manager, that there was going to be some monster that, and that like I hadn't found that. And I was left with this big question, which is like, okay, well, if it's not nefarious people, if it's not villains, then what is it? And that was kind of like back in 2020 when I started this podcast. That was what I was on a quest to understand. And still, to a certain extent, I'm on a quest to understand, though I think I'm a little bit further along in my thinking. And I think the narrative is that what drives behavior is intention. And that like you have bad people who are out to do bad things, you know? And actually, what we found in this mini series and what I also found sort of in my own like experience on the production floor was that what drives behavior is the context, you know, and in our case, that context is the inequity. And so like the first like layer of this is like, okay, how do we reframe the conversation about what drives behavior? And like I've shared this with Divya before, but I was recently reading a book, and in that book, the author was talking about a British like criminologist who was doing research about, you know, why people run away from school. And the research was focused on like identifying common personality traits in individuals in his study. And what he found was that actually there were no personality traits in common in this group of people who were running away from school. But what they did have in common was the school. They were running away from the school. They were running away from the context. And I thought, oh, this is like such a great analogy for this kind of like narrative shift that we're trying to see, which is that like, I think all of the tools and all of the like approaches that we have within this project that we call sustainability are sort of focused on that personality. How do we make sure that this person behaves in the right way? And almost none of it is how do we actually look at the context in which this person is operating to, you know, drive a different kind of behavior or a different kind of choices. And I've tried to have this conversation with a lot of different people, and it makes people really uncomfortable. I get a lot of pushback because they're like, yeah, but I've been in this factory and this person was just like, this was bad, you know? And people like have a really hard time. And then I kind of try to reframe it. And I'm like, okay, well, it's a spectrum. In some cases, maybe you do have a really bad person who's just out to like screw people over. But like, if that's where you focus on the spectrum, it's not useful framing because you miss everything else. And then people are kind of like, okay, maybe I could live with that. I've been kind of surprised at the pushback and the sort of unwillingness to let go of that narrative. So that's like the first layer. What drives behavior? Then the second question is, okay, well, what is the relevant context? And I've said it already, but I think it's inequity. That's kind of in many ways what you both said. It's inequity that's driving this behavior, or that's driving people to make choices or to do bad stuff. And then the question, of course, is, well, what is driving that inequity? And that's kind of like the third layer. So there's three kind of conversations that need to be had. And maybe depending on where people are at, you sort of start the conversation in different like places. Is somebody still in this first layer where we're just still trying to shift the framing? Or if someone's been sort of like persuaded of that, are we then in the second layer, which is like, how do we make a compelling case that actually the context that's relevant in this case is the inequity? And I think that this mini series makes that case quite compellingly. And then if you get people on board with that, then it's okay, well, where does the inequity come from? And what is driving that inequity? And that's sort of like the third layer of the cake. I said cake, I haven't referred to a cake, but you know what I mean. And here I heard a few different things from you guys, because I heard, Jennifer, from you, the business model is what's driving that inequity. And then I heard from you, Divya, it's the rules themselves that is driving that inequity. But then I would say, I would add to that, because one of the things that I was reflecting on in these episodes, or that was new for me that I hadn't considered, was also how like the place can drive inequity. And by the place, I mean things that are very specific and unique to a given place, whether that's the relationship between, in this case, Westminster and local government, or whether that's like legal status that people have. You know, Shaista talked about different groups of workers and how their legal status or their personal situation, whether they had kids or didn't have kids, and how that intersected with, you know, the way that the type of government assistance or welfare, like social support that they were getting from the government, like how all of those things intersected to drive them to sort of have different stakes in the status quo, let's say. So I don't know, I kind of, how I see it is like, okay, three layers. I see the rules themselves, and by rules, and I should say that's also the other thing that really surprised me about this series. This series is about legislation, but really what we're talking about is not only legislation, it's rules of any kind. And also norms, I would say. It's things that sort of govern the way that we behave. And that could be at a legal level. It could be also like within, the rules that govern decision-making within a multi-stakeholder organization. And I was surprised that the implications were kind of so much broader than just the legal space. So three buckets: the rules themselves, the business model, and maybe things that are specific to the place that then kind of like intersect with the rules or intersect with the business model and kind of shape this whole picture. So that's where I'm at.
Okay, so a couple of thoughts just coming to mind to kind of throw into the mix as we think about it. I think your point about the intention or the individual is interesting, and it kind of, you know, more very, very broadly, and I'm thinking about, you know, the classroom setting that I engage in, we always have this question that, is it a case of bad apple or is it a case of bad barrels? You know, that's the fundamental question, that are we dealing with a world which is full of sociopaths, you know, and psychopaths within a business setting, because we reflect on, you know, this concept of business ethics, so to speak, or is there something else going on? I think the analysis shows that it is not that people are inherently bad. It is when you are caught up and acting according to, you know, what some would call in accordance with particular scripts. There's this interesting case, you know, of Ford Pinto, and I think I've mentioned this to you, the piece by Denise Joya.
Elaborate on it a little if you can.
So it was basically, that Joya was the field recall officer at the time with Ford Pinto. He was
Ford Pinto, you mean the Ford Motor Plant?
Yeah, the car company, which was, you know, the back of the car, there was something faulty and the car was just blowing up on the road.
So you're talking about an academic piece that is written by somebody who became an academic, who was looking at a recall of a particular model of car in a Ford plant. Like, he's reflecting on an incident that he was personally involved in when he was working at Ford.
Yeah.
But now was looking at from an academic lens.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Continue.
Yeah. Yes, that was a very clear summary. So in his reflection, what he says is that when I was going into the company, I went in because I wanted to change, you know, the way business is done. And very soon, very quickly, I got co-opted, you know, within the framing. And I was operating at the time, he says, according to the prevalent scripts within the organization. his day job was to examine accidents and to issue a recall for a vehicle if it met a particular criteria. And because this one did not meet that, though it was worrying, he, as he says, you know, almost became immune. So those are the kinds of situations. And if you examine and think about it, and indeed even speak to, you know, colleagues within our industry, you would hear this enough and more, right? That at a particular time, at a particular context, they acted according to the prevalent rules and norms, as you would call it. So that was something which came into mind. Or the other way you would have come across this, they refer to this in the name of banality of evil.
I want to just interject and give a little bit of context. So when we're thinking about, okay, what drives people to do bad stuff, one of the classic sort of case studies or things that people look at when they're looking at this question, what drives people to do bad stuff, is the Holocaust, right? How is it possible that this happened? And Hannah Arendt was a Jewish German woman who fled the Holocaust and then afterwards went to the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem, and Eichmann was being prosecuted by the newly formed Israeli state for his involvement in the Holocaust. So she then wrote a series of articles in the New Yorker, which then later became a book. And like one of the things that was so provocative about what she said is in her description of Eichmann, she was like, this is just a regular guy. Like, this is not the like villain I was expecting. And she describes him and she's like, this guy was somebody who was just following orders. His like ethical justification for what he was doing, and I'm probably butchering it, was that he was doing his job. And she then coined the term like the banality of evil and being like, you know, evil doesn't always happen because you have this like monster. It's the way that people are interacting with the rules and like the norms of the society. Okay, context given. Divya, I let you pick back up.
The point I was getting at, Kim, you know, when you were saying we need to think about the context, right? Or we need to think about beyond the individual, what is that context? And then we are talking about inequity, which I think we need to also kind of maybe discuss that and tease that out a little bit more. If we are saying that there is no, you know, nefarious villain out there and that it is possible, and I think that's why I bring in Arendt, and her broader work is basically a provocation for us to think. Basically, her argument being that, you know, evil is not necessarily monstrous. It can take place under the guise of, you know, normality. So then what does that mean? And in our case, when we are thinking about these codes, to what extent are they actually constituting some of this context or rules, as you would call them, which is making some of these things even more problematic?
You mean like what role? And I think this is what we're getting at when I said, okay, what causes inequity? And that I sort of heard three buckets of things. And it's like within that sort of rules bucket, I think what you're saying, Divya, is that one of the things you're interested in exploring, or what some of the things that came out in these conversations around Lester, is actually how the rules are making that inequity worse because they're further empowering the beneficiaries of the status quo. And that like the inequity is both the cause and the result. It's the cause of the rules being the way that they are, but then it's also the result of those rules. If I imagine sort of like, I don't know, like some kind of a mill or some kind of a funnel. At the top, you're putting inequity in. Out of that comes a set of rules that benefit or further empowers the beneficiaries of the status quo. And then the result of that is inequity that's even worse. And to give a like very practical example, I was recently like writing something about traceability, which I haven't published yet. But that was kind of like, and I wouldn't put this in the published piece, but at the end I was like, can I put a facepalm emoji in this like article? Because I was like, you ask, why is traceability so difficult? And like, why isn't it happening? And I would tell you, like, it's not a data problem. Everybody knows who they're buying from and who they're selling from. Every con farmer knows who they're selling from. Every ginner knows who their vendors are, who their suppliers are, and who they're selling to. I, as a factory manager, knew where I was buying fabric from and who I was selling my like finished garments to. The data exists. It's not a data problem. We don't want to share it. That's the problem. And that's like the issue with traceability. And meanwhile, we have all of these solutions like technology platforms for traceability that cost suppliers thousands of euros. They have to have whole teams dedicated to inputting the data in these platforms. And oh, by the way, not only are they footing the bill for all of this, they're the ones paying for the goods stuck in customs. And sometimes other people are taking that data, which they are giving away for free, and making money off of it. And I'm going to bring this back to this conversation, because if you think about, okay, why people don't want to share it, because of inequity, because there is no sort of protection as a supplier that that information will not be used against me to either negotiate lower prices, or that my brand, in my case, because I was at the garment level, that that brand might not just go to my fabric supplier and take their cut and sew work somewhere else. And why can the brand do that to me as a factory? Because of inequity. Meanwhile, we've created a whole set of rules that is trying to drive transparency, which is actually only making this inequity worse, because suppliers are now having to pay for IT platforms, they're having to pay for staff, they're having to pay for like all kinds of products stuck in customs. And it's just like, yeah, can I get a facepalm emoji, please? Sorry, done. Jennifer.
So many thoughts. But going back to this initial question of intention, something that I have learned, not just in Leicester, but in life and in my former career as a prosecutor, every human being has good intentions. And I don't think intentions are necessarily relevant. And we all come up with reasons why we do the things we do. So if we do something like we claim benefits when we're not entitled to benefits, or if we don't pay somebody minimum wage, we all have reasons for why we do it. I mean, there's the practical, rational reasons. And I mean, we bring up Eichmann now. So how did the Holocaust happen? Well, people were following their orders. And you can easily say, well, if I don't follow my orders, I could get executed or I will lose my position. And I have children that are dependent on me, then I have obligations down the road. So what I'm doing, even though I'm engaging in murder and genocide, I'm protecting my children. So I think just as human beings, we're just wired to justify anything that we do. Now, where it's different, and bringing it back to the garment industry and business models, whereas you and I and every individual has a good intention and wants to do the right thing, corporations, brands, and businesses and manufacturers, they don't exist. They are not human. They are legal fictions. They don't have morals and ethics. They might have, you know, principles that we all are going to sign on to, and this is who we are as an organization. Their behavior is also very rational and realistic, and that is to make money and stay in business. So what we're having to do, and you heard this many, many times in the series that we've been recording, is that I have to do this. I have to pay my employees £3 an hour, because if I don't, they won't have a job at all. And isn't that the worst crime? And these are the things that I'm doing to support my community, to give jobs, to create jobs. Let's go back to what is the whole purpose of the legislation. And the way it's been implemented on a realistic way is through this top-down approach. And it's created social audits. It's created codes of conduct. It's created lots of things that are being done to keep the brands and the retailers and their supply chain protected from being associated with these bad things going on. However, what if we flip our approach to why we've adopted this legislation in the first place? We're adopting this legislation saying that there are risks, very real and proven, to the environment and to the human rights of workers in these supply chains. What if we took all of the resource that's being done to protect the corporations, and we said, okay, no, let's start with workers having to make choices in order to survive and feed their families. And let's address those issues down there. And then, you know, maybe gradually, it's like the reverse of trickle-down economics. Let's put everything into building up the bottom base. And then eventually, wouldn't it be nice if that ended up trickling up so that the brands can get a profit down the road?
Yes, but I mean, what you're making me question is, you know, the fundamental role of like business and society and the relationship between business and government. Because the difference between the socialist way, right, the way the state was set up versus when we think about free market and, you know, the capital playing a role in developing a particular, you know, place or society or enabling people. And I think that boils down to our very conception of who a citizen is. The way human rights emerged was because we kind of said that these are a bundle of rights which each of us as an individual are endowed with, right? And those need to be protected, which assumes and imagines a particular way the society is organized. There are others who actually argue for a more social, you know, form of approach, and they argue that actually you can conceptualize citizenship perhaps differently. I think coming back to our industry, given where we are at, to what extent is it possible for this single industry to kind of break away from the grain? We heard in Leicester, and I think it emerged in two conversations, that, you know, but we had to get into fast fashion, and perhaps that was a mistake. You know, I think Saj mentioned. But the question then comes in that, is there a different form through which, you know, you can organize the industry? And to what extent, within the wider constraints, you know, which a global market poses, can actually Leicester or UK behave like a, you know, island? And that is very true for various other settings.
So I see sort of like two directions that this conversation is going down. On the one hand, Jennifer, you talked about these are companies, these are legal entities, they're not individuals. And also this is a business, right? This is not like a democratic state where it's not the same as an individual who is a citizen of a place where, you know, they're sort of supposed to have, hypothetically, at least on paper, equal rights. So that's one path that I see this conversation going down, is like, how do we make sense of that? If we're saying, okay, it's not intention that's driving this behavior, it's the context, and that context is inequity, but at the same time, a corporation is, or a company is not an individual, it's a legal entity, and it's governed by a set of commercial relationships, not like individual relationships. And the other direction I see is this conversation around rules. And I go back to my three layers of things and what drives inequity, and rules being one of those things. And Jennifer, I think this is what you were alluding to, and you too, Divya, with like your sort of flip the script on the legislation bottom up as opposed to trickle down. And Divya, I think in other ways you've also kind of spoken to this, but how do we sort of start to examine the ways that the rules, because we think of rules as neutral, I think, and we actually haven't really talked about that, because I think within this conversation, nobody thinks that. But in sort of the wider world, I think there is a perception that rules can be neutral. And so how do we start to sort of see the ways in which the rules are not neutral? So I want to come back to both of these points, but I want to start with the first one. And I want to pick that conversation up by sharing with you conversation that I had recently, a very candid conversation with somebody that was working for a very influential sustainability organization. And that person said to me, and I'm paraphrasing, "Kim, you know, I understand that inequity across the value chain is a barrier to our sustainability goals because it's leading to approaches within sustainability that put the interests of one value chain group over the collective interest. But the thing I can't reconcile is that this industry is still a business. There will always be buyers and there will always be sellers, and there's a certain amount of inequity or a certain sort of way that power is distributed in that relationship. And so how do I square that?" And I think that's maybe a very like practical illustration of some of the kind of abstract things we've been talking about. And so I want to give you each a chance to share, you know, if you had been the one in this conversation, what would you have said to this person?
I mean, this is always the justification, isn't it? This is the question, right? What is a business for? So the way I think about it, historically, the idea of business or a corporation came up when they were commissioned by the state to, you know, set up railroad, for example, right? And they were state-owned corporations and entities. And over a period of, you know, different years for different reasons, you know, and now we have, you know, state almost retreating, and businesses and companies being recognized and more powerful, playing, you know, more and more roles, having this expectation that they need to step in when, you know, Ukraine and Russia are, you know, interacting. So playing increasingly a role of, which is more political, which was historically about individuals. So I think that is where this speaks to what you were saying, Jen, that it is a legal fiction, and by the merit of that, and there is so many cases where it is just not possible to pin down or attribute responsibility because of the way a corporation is set up. And I think this question that is being raised is that we are acknowledging now, as business actors dealing with these large amounts of resources, that actually that is limiting. So, you know, what should we be doing about it? Should we be just saying that actually this is what a business is designed to do? We can see that we are headed to a crash, but we can't do anything about it. Or is it possible to navigate in a different manner, to think about the range of ideas which have emerged overall, I would say, in the podcast so far, not just, you know, our series or the previous series, about thinking about the way it's costed, the way product designing is done, the way you think about including workers, you know, the questions of voice. Is there a way to think about it differently? So when, you know, I would have actually said that if we recognize that, can we at least in the first instance begin to have a wider conversation about this? That's the first step. Because, you know, neither him alone or her alone as an individual will be able to implement it. We have these leading companies who, you know, control a larger percent of the market share. So can we begin with a conversation there that what is it that we can perhaps do differently? I'm coming back and connecting this to Lester because alongside the series or shortly after, Jen and I have been working with an experiment, if I should call it, about is it possible to actually park constraints and think about reimagining? And I don't know where we land with it, but at least we've started that conversation in Lester.
Have like acknowledgement of this tension in a sort of public way be the first step. Hi, sometimes I feel kind of like a madwoman sitting in my living room recording myself talk. If you want to help me with that feeling, share your musings, ramblings, or questions, whether fully formed or half-baked, by leaving me a voice memo or posting to our Curious Case of Lester community wall, where you can also swap notes with fellow listeners. Links to both the voice memo and the community wall can be found in the episode description. Also, join us for a live virtual conversation on October 3rd to debrief and compare notes on these episodes. Spots are limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. Register via the link in the episode description. How about you, Jennifer? How would you have responded? I'll just put the statement out there again so it's fresh in people's mind. What this person said to me is, Kim, I understand that inequity across the value chain is a barrier to our sustainability goals because it's leading to approaches that put the interests of one value chain group over the collective interest. But the thing I'm struggling with is that this industry is still a business. There will always be buyers and sellers, and there's a certain amount of inequity in that. How would you have responded to this person?
That's the economic model in which our world is dependent on. It's the driver, it's the foundation, it's the rules, it's the culture that we have. We can throw that out the window, but I don't think that's going to happen. And I want to go back again to why did we adopt these rules and legislation in the first place? It's because of a recognition that there is inequality and there is damage that's occurring. I think one of the most powerful parts of the podcast series was Shaista. At the end, she's saying, you know, I've been doing this work for years and, you know, we came in to fix these problems because we want to have cleaner supply chains. And the result of that, sadly, is, well, we've lost the jobs now. The people who we're trying to protect.
It's made it worse.
It's been worse for them. So going back to why these laws exist in the first place. Let's flip it and let's start there.
Yeah. And despite all of the good intentions, that's the like swishing around visual that I have if I'm like seeing a funnel. You know, we've done all this stuff to try and fix it. And then at the other end, somehow it's worse. And I agree with you. I think that was like one of the most powerful parts of the show. And actually, and I haven't shared what I responded to this person. It was actually a little bit different to what I think you guys responded. I'm not sure if it necessarily like made much sense. But for me, what this question kind of triggered was like, it used to be that we could think about self-interest in a very sort of narrow kind of way. I could think about my self-interest, you could think about your self-interest, and we'd come up with a set of rules that would like mediate that. And now with the types of challenges that we're up against, it's like we almost have to redefine self-interest and like make it broader. And not just because like, oh, I'm some kind of good-hearted do-gooder, but because I recognize that it is now in my self-interest to put the collective interest first. When I think about a business, that's almost like the shift. And I don't know how that fits in with rules and all of the rest. You know, this was somebody who was, you know, working for a fairly influential sustainability organization. If I think about like the organizations that are leading these conversations, that's almost, Divya, to your point, yes, I would like to see acknowledgement. But then what I would also like to see is a discussion around, at a mindset level and at a belief level, how do we sort of shift the way that we understand self-interest? That was my response. But this segues, I think, very nicely also to where I kind of wanted to end this conversation, which is I had a conversation with my brother recently, not about this series. He doesn't even really, I don't think, know that it's happening, but he is a lawyer. And he often moonlights as my intellectual sounding board. And he recently sent me a text message. And yes, this is what our text messages look like sometimes. He said, you know, when we talk about power and inequities in any context, whether within our sector or otherwise, too often I think we take the distribution of power as given, and we are constrained in our thinking about what's possible. We don't necessarily see the ways the existing system is set up to create the consequent power dynamics, and we don't recognize that those things are, in fact, a choice. So I'm going to pause. The way we define self-interest is a choice. The way we talk about what is the role of business is a choice. All of these things are a choice. And I think for me, that's really inspiring. The way we structure supply chains, I've written a number of articles about this. The fact that we have such long and complicated supply chains, and that is a choice that benefits the brands and the retailers, and it is the consequence of those brands and retailers offloading their financial risk. Because each actor along the supply chain then is left in a situation where they can't cope with the amount of financial risk that they've been asked to assume, and so they try to push it down even further to someone else until it lands with the most vulnerable. And yet, the start of our conversation around sustainability, so often when you hear brands and retailers talk, is, oh, well, it's so hard for me to know what's happening in our supply chains because our supply chains are so long and so complicated. That is not an inevitability. And so he, my brother, in this text message exchange, went on to suggest that I should read Robert Hale's Coercion and Distribution in a Supposedly Non-Coercive State, because that's the kind of stuff that he reads. And he was saying that, you know, the central idea of this article is that when governments protect a property right, they are not only abstaining from interfering with that property, they are also actively preventing non-property owners from doing anything with that property. And so what he says is the article is pointing out that there really isn't such a thing as governments not getting involved. Them getting involved is a choice to stay out of it, or is a choice to stay out of it, free from consequences. It's a choice to empower the beneficiaries of the status quo. And then he goes on to give me more examples. During the Spanish Civil War, the eventual Allied governments tried to stay out of it. They didn't want the fascists to win, but they were worried about the communists tied with the leftist Republicans. They therefore withheld their aid as if that was a quote-unquote neutral decision. But because Hitler and Mussolini didn't have the same qualms and helped Franco, the sort of quote-unquote neutral decision was in effect a decision in favor of Franco. Neutrality is a myth revealed by a change in perspective, his words. He goes, another useful example is the idea of organ donation. Really, we should have just had him on the show. But he goes, if a country has a system where people have to opt in to donate organs, the donation rate is generally around 20%. If they have a system where people have to opt out, the rate of donation is generally around 80%. These numbers aren't quite right, but they're close enough to illustrate the point, he says. And then he says there isn't truly a neutral way for the government to design the system. Every option creates a change in behavior relative to a different option. Even in a forced choice, for example, the government doesn't have as opt out or in, they just say, hey, everybody, you have to make a choice one way or another or pay a fine. You're still influencing people to behave differently by setting it up that way relative to the alternatives. And so if under forced choice, 50% donate, then that means that 30% of the people are behaving differently than they otherwise would because you changed how the system was set up. So every way of presenting the choice influences behavior depending on what you choose as your reference. So I think it goes back to, I want to repeat one of the earlier sentences, which is neutrality is a myth revealed by a change in perspective. So I know that was really long, but the reason I share it is because ultimately legislation, whether in Leicester or otherwise, is about rules. And Divya, you've talked about this. Jennifer, you, I think this is kind of what you're getting at when you're like, I want to sort of flip the way we think about rules and start with like, okay, we know this inequity is happening and why don't we start there and then sort of work our way up? But rules inevitably have a point of view on the distribution of power and on inequity. And if it's that inequity that's driving all of this unsustainable behavior in Leicester and also beyond, then how do we make it easier for people to see the way that the rules actually create inequity? How do we make it easier to see that the way power is distributed is in fact a choice, not an inevitability? Or if I again return to this line from my brother, when we take the distribution of power as given, we are constrained in our thinking about what's possible. How do we help people to open our collective imaginations as to what's possible?
I mean, so at a very individual level, I think it's about this reflection that rather than saying that this is how the world is, I think the question is, does it have to be? Because no matter which setting, you know, where you go and which kind of a conversation room you enter across the globe in our industry, I mean, I have heard the same narrative because we've imagined a particular kind of consumer. As businesses, I think it's important to remember that there is something which has been referred to as choice editing. You know, what are the options that are actually available in the supermarket, and which is where we recognize that brands are so, so powerful in the kind of behaviors they can propagate. And the reason I chose to work with the fashion industry as an empirical setting is because people connect to it so strongly. If we are thinking about changing behavior rather than saying that, oh, you know, the consumer behavior is something that we can't understand. I mean, all of the marketing power and, you know, creativity is currently focused on mass consumption. It's about that kind of a reflection. Is it possible to reimagine a different kind of industry? And what is it that we can do within the resources and the limitations to perhaps work towards it? That's one. And the second aspect, I think, thinking about the rules is, again, to recognize that, you know, the rules inherently are about allocating power. Perhaps the way to do so at a very practical, tangible level is this question of voice, which we have, you know, heard in the series previously. We've spoken about worker voice. The whole podcast is about supplier voice.
And with Saj, we talked about a lot about like the role of the association in giving manufacturers a collective voice.
And within that, I have to bring this in, you know, this is from my wider experience, even within the organization, within the brands, within international organizations, the dynamic between their local offices and the international offices, be it standard organizations or brands, there is a particular dynamic there which we are not sufficiently acknowledging. We are coloring all of them, you know, with the same color. So maybe when we are thinking about this rule setting, rule making, we think of a way that one is, you know, a rule kind of written in text. What happens when it is translated in practice? And what will happen if those who are supposed to be implementing it or those who are supposed to be benefiting from it, the point that, you know, Jen is talking about, that if it is about protecting the workers, how is it possible that we actually bring in the voices of the workers from the shop floors and integrate that? And that's where we kind of square in with a place-based approach. This is complex. This is by no means simple, but what we have is also complex, right? And we've worked our way up to that in some manner. And I feel, you know, given some of the conversations, that there is a league of, you know, professionals within this industry who is aching for change, because a lot of them are getting fed up and actually quitting the industry and doing something else because they're like, I can't really do this, you know. So many merchandisers and so many, you know, young professionals.
But even sustainability people.
Yeah, which is why I said that coming around the table and having a conversation is really the first step. Because if you go back to the history of how these standards, you know, how GRI was set up, how Rainforest Alliance or FLA was set up, it happened because there was a problem and people came around the table to think of a solution. At that point, that self-interest definition was very narrow. We were aware, but perhaps we were not as aware. And I think there is hope. You know, the reason I do the job I do is because I want to believe that the next generation of, you know, individuals joining the industry, can I influence and, you know, help them to think about some of these things.
Jennifer, what are you thinking?
First of all, I want to hang out with you and your brother sometime.
So half the time our conversations are like this, and half the time our conversation are like level of 5-year-olds, like, you know, hey, you like took my thing, you know, or like, and also the context I should add is that one of the like sparring points between my brother is I was almost a lawyer. And I had applied to McGill because this was like the best place to go and do human rights law, or one of the places that was known for, you know, human rights law. And, you know, the reason I dropped out was in many ways because of this conversation we're having now. Like, law school is about learning the rules. And I wasn't interested in learning the rules. What I was interested in is like, who makes the rules? Whose interests do they represent and reflect? And I could not get behind the idea that like rules are neutral. And that's why I decided that it wasn't for me.
Well, no, it's interesting because similarly, I went into law because I believed that the solutions lie with the rules and with the institutions and with the government that has the power. So we need these systems, and that's the framework that we need in order to, quote, fix the world. I mentioned this in an earlier series that I left the law, I left government, a long career in government, because I realized that the power of government is quite diminished, and all the power exists with the businesses and the corporations. And so I did my MBA and began focusing on business and human rights. And like, okay, well, the businesses will have the answers. Obviously, that's been disproven as well. But, you know, going back to some of the stuff about your picking up on your brother's point, and one of my favorite quotes is, you know, the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who in times of great moral crisis maintain their neutrality. I think that's Dante's Inferno, but I could be wrong about that. But what your main points are is that this, if we take away the constraints of what we currently have, it does create opportunity and hope in our thinking. And bringing this back to Lester and what I intend to carry forward, not just from this podcast series, but also from the, I think Divya called it an experiment, but a program that GIF is carrying forward in Leicester over the next few months.
And GIF is?
I'm sorry, Justice and Fashion.
Which is the organization that you're leading.
Yes. So Justice and Fashion has been doing all of this work in Leicester for the last few years. So what Justice and Fashion intends to do going forward is to remove the constraints, the realities that currently exist in our thinking. And
how?
Well, right now it's sort of a workshop exercise that creates a visioning opportunity that is not based on reality. And is that going to open up some space in our thinking and help Leicester, at least, create its own narrative and shift it and say, this is who we are, this is what we want, and become proactive in its future rather than reactive? So what has been happening for years and years and years, I think in many, many sectors and across the economy and under the capitalist structure, is we go where the money is and we sort of chase that as the model. But what if you could take on a place-based approach a community like Leicester and an industry, the garment industry in Leicester, and instead say, you know what, these are our values as a community collectively. We believe in a local supply chain, in investing in innovation for the most sustainable fabrics ever. All of our factories have glass walls that anybody can come in and see. We believe in producing these fibers locally. And is it possible, if we can just create that vision and then work collectively towards that vision, then we can be proactive and not reactive in attracting the business and the investment, potentially. So we'll see how it goes. This is our effort to say, okay, well, let's create a new framework. Let's open up our thinking and let's try to do this.
So I want to try and wrap up this conversation with like three very practical thoughts that come to mind as like, and if I summarize, if I go back to where we started, why is this stuff still happening in Leicester? Well, at the end of the day, inequity. What causes that inequity? A bunch of different stuff, but actually the rules themselves have a role to play in that. And that's one of the things that is not currently being acknowledged. So if I sort of pause there and say, okay, then where do we pivot to? Where do we go from here? I have sort of three practical suggestions, and I want to see what you think, and maybe that's where we can close the conversation. But number one, acknowledge, like for people working in this industry, acknowledge that inequity is what is driving all of this bad stuff. Number two, acknowledge that the rules might mean different things depending on the context in which you're working. It might be the way that your organization works. It might be the legal framework. It might be something else. But acknowledge that the rules are not neutral, cannot be neutral. And acknowledge who is currently benefiting from those rules. Have that conversation. So that's my second suggestion. And number three, focus on process. And this came out, Divya, you suggested it in one of the episodes. How do we decide what the rules should be, rather than talking about what the substance or the content of those rules should be? How do we come up with a process that ensures that the rules are in the interest or serve the interest of the collective, rather than the interest of one stakeholder group? And maybe, Jennifer, part of that is talking about vision. What do we want to be? What is in our collective interest? Articulating that. And can we as an industry come up with principles for a process for arriving at the rules? And then the result, what comes out of that process, will be extremely contextual, I think. So rather than trying to come up with universal rules that make sense for everyone, everywhere, can we align on a process that sort of ensures that those rules benefit the collective rather than further empowering the beneficiaries of the status quo?
I love it, first of all. I absolutely love it, especially the third one. Maybe we focus on the process. And I think that's where justice and fashion has kind of landed as a strategy at a very local level for what is in the collective interests of the community in Leicester, and what is the process for creating that vision, and then how do we build the roads to get to that and to deliver that vision. So I completely agree there. I think the challenge that exists globally and also somewhat locally in Leicester is, like you said, can we acknowledge that the rules aren't neutral and who the rules are benefiting? And when the people that those rules are benefiting have power, and the very nature, the whole purpose of power is to retain that power. And it is very rare for someone to surrender the power that they have. So I would say that is going to require something different than just ideas.
Well, it comes back to this point on self-interest. Right? And sort of shifting our understanding of self-interest, that given the nature of the climate crisis and the types of challenges that we are up against, we have to shift our understanding of self-interest, that it is in my self-interest for the collective to be better off, because otherwise the planet will be on fire. And what good is me having amassed tons of wealth if, like, I don't have a place to live? Like, I think there are certain investors and stuff that are starting to think like this as well. And that's why my second point was, like, acknowledge that the rules are not neutral and let's have a conversation about who benefits. Because if you don't have that conversation, you can't have a conversation about, well, what's in the collective interest? Because those with power, I think, genuinely think that what's in their interest is what's in the collective interest.
I would just add, I think I agree with what both of you have said. To add to what you've said, to be reflexive in this process, which basically means being mindful, because it's very, very easy. And we have had this, that, you know, we come up with something, there's lots of creative energy invested in the very beginning, and then we just want to simplify life, right? We want to abstract everything. And I think it's almost like a commitment somewhere that we kind of integrate complexity and the burden that it generates within this conversation, within the acknowledgement, because it's a burdensome acknowledgement, and indeed the process, and remain reflexive throughout, because there are so many initiatives which have started with saying, yes, we will include, you know, voices, and then you have pseudo representation of the voices.
There's inclusion without talking about process, without a re-examining of the process. And that's like one of the things that I feel like I'm just shouting into a void. Somehow I become like a spokesperson for supplier perspectives on sustainability. But like, as a result, I get tons of people being like, oh, we want to engage suppliers. Please help us engage suppliers. And I'll give you a very specific example. I had somebody come to me and say, we want to like survey suppliers on, you know, how this legislation in the global north is impacting them and what their challenges are. Can you please like help us do this survey? And I was like, first of all, you're a huge organization with tons of resources, and you're coming to me, a freelancer, to be like, can I please give my time for free to help you like figure out what should be in the survey? And I said, nobody's going to respond to your survey if you don't first have a conversation about the process. This was an organization that works with a lot of different types of stakeholders and is doing lobbying at the EU level on sort of behalf of industry. And I was like, you will not get any suppliers to respond to your survey if you don't first have a conversation about process. What accountability is there? If suppliers give you their insights and somebody other another stakeholder gives you other insights or has a different point of view, how are you going to decide what the message is that you take to Brussels? I said, I need to understand how that decision making is going to happen. And then the person came back to me and said, yeah, but what about my request to have a meeting? One of the reasons why this like whole exchange that I've just described was so upsetting for me was because I was like, I didn't respond. And then I was like, oh, the narrative in this person on the receiving end's head is probably going to be like, oh, well, I tried to reach out and I tried to sort of include suppliers in this process. And I tried to ask Kim and Kim didn't respond. And it sort of pushes that burden back on me. And I felt frustrated with myself because it's like, that's where I left it. And I wasn't able to like articulate or to be like, look, you asking for supplier input in this case is something that you are doing to feel good about yourself so that you can pat yourself on the back and say, I have tried and they didn't come. When in fact, the reason they are not coming is because of the rules. It's because of the process for arriving at a sort of decision or an outcome. And how do I, in a one email exchange, put all of that on the table?
And it's not about inclusion in some ways. It is about co-creation, co-defining, if you know what I mean. And I think that's what I mean about the process. Like when we are revisiting, it's about, I think, this premise that, oh, and this is the classic, you know, of stakeholder engagement. Come, let's engage stakeholders. You know, these are the things we are doing. Here are the surveys. Here are the, you know, meetings we did. It is very top down again, right? We are not opening up the space for saying we are actually willing to share power. And yes, if you disagree, okay, maybe we are gonna, you know, park this one. And I don't know to what extent. It is challenging, but I would not like to believe that it is not possible. And that's the reason, Jen, that I kind of use the word experiment, because on the global scale of things, I think, you know, what GIF is embarking on is an experiment. And there are dynamics, and that's the other thing, and that's what I meant by acknowledging the complexity and acknowledging the politics, you know, because we are, again, not on neutral grounds, but being more aware of it perhaps, you know, leaves more doors and spaces open rather than them being shut down and people being shut out of just because it's difficult, because people don't want to have difficult conversations. And I think my whole work and research is kind of driven by, let's just have those difficult conversations. And I am so glad that you've come up with, you know, a ways that perhaps we can, in this series, continue those conversations. Because going back to the start, I think we said this in the first episode, that this is about opening up a space for conversations. And I think that's what I'm really looking forward to. Even with this episode, you know, reactions and questions and, I don't know, your memo box being full and your Padlet being populated and indeed, you know, the event that we have coming.
I want to repeat the line because I want to leave this on sort of like an inspirational note. And for me, like when I'm having bad days or when I'm doubting myself, this is a line that I come back to. And specifically when we think about legislation, I mean, that's ultimately what this series has been about, is what's the role of legislation? And the line that I continue to come back to, which I shared early already, is when we take the distribution of power as given, we are constrained in our thinking about what's possible. And so in all these conversations around legislation, how can we sort of think about legislation and rules more generally as a tool to actually change the way that power is distributed, because it is not a given. We do not have to take the distribution of power as it is today as given. We don't. And when we're thinking about legislation, that's the conversation that I'd want to be having. How do we use legislation as a way to think or to change the way that power is distributed? Let's close there. Thank you both for this conversation.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Manufactured. I've been your host, Kim van der Weert, and if you learned something new from this episode and want to support the show, come say hi to me on LinkedIn. Also, share your musings, ramblings, or questions about this episode, whether fully formed or half-baked, by leaving me a voice memo or posting to our Curious Case of Leicester community wall, where you can also swap notes with fellow listeners. Also, join us for a live virtual conversation on the 3rd of October to debrief and compare notes about these episodes. Spots are limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. Links to the voice memo, community wall, and event registration page can be found in the episode description. And of course, subscribe, rate, and review us on the podcast app you're listening to this episode on.